You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk with UW-Madison's winter commencement speaker about the advice he plans to give students and why it took him years after graduation to develop his own Wisconsin pride. First, a new poll shows how people in Wisconsin feel about the impeachment proceedings against President Trump and the 2020 Democratic presidential field. Results from the Marquette University Law School poll were released yesterday. It was conducted last week and surveyed 800 registered voters. The margin of error is a little more than 4%. Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School poll. He's also co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, good to talk with you again.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Before we get into the results, remind us, whether it's a Marquette poll or anybody's poll, what is it important for people, maybe for voters, to keep in mind as they look at this kind of information?
I think the most important thing is to remember that none of this is permanent. Things can change. They can also stay the same. And that in a period with new information, new news coming out, it wouldn't be that surprising to see a variety of results. At the moment, the national polling is fairly consistent, though.
And it looks like there aren't big changes on some big things here in Wisconsin, including what people think of impeachment. What do you see this time around?
Yeah, I think stability is definitely the takeaway from this month's poll. This time in December, we have 40% favoring impeach and remove and 52 opposed. It was 40 and 53 a month ago. So hardly changed. A month ago, it dipped down just slightly. It had been 44 favoring impeachment and 51 opposed in October. So from October to November, just a bit of a decline in support for impeachment. But then after the conclusion of public testimony, no change as a result of that testimony. People's opinions stayed rock solid from November to December.
You also asked if people thought that the president had done something wrong when it came to what we've been talking about with Ukraine. What did people have to say about that?
Here, too, almost no change. 42% said it was seriously wrong what he did. 37 said he'd done nothing wrong at all. And a month ago, it was 42-38. 1 point difference between those. There's another 9% both months that say what he did was wrong, but it really wasn't that serious.
Let me throw one possible read of this at you, Charles, and see what you think of it. I know we can't read the minds of everybody, but what's happening here could be that everybody is dug in. They know which side they're on, and facts one way or the other, they're going to be pretty impervious to them. What do you think about that hypothesis?
I think that's a good hypothesis. You'd get an A in my class.
Yay.
When we asked about this, about did the testimony move people? Because we had very direct testimony in the public hearings on this. 52% believed that Trump asked Ukraine to investigate on his behalf. 29% deny that. But 18% say they really don't know, despite the 2 weeks of testimony. And that's completely unchanged from last month. As to whether he withheld aid, military aid, to pressure Ukraine, 44% this month think he did do that. That is up 3 points from 41% last time, but it's only up 3 points. And 36% still believe that he did not do that, with almost one in five, 19%, saying they don't know whether he did it or not. So I think this is a pretty strong indication that 2 weeks of testimony that was widely covered and pretty widely watched or listened to did not produce any substantial shift in either how people viewed the facts of the case or how they evaluate whether what he did was wrong or seriously wrong, or whether he should be impeached and removed. We just don't see any movement across all four of these questions.
And then that reminds me, you also asked people how closely they were following the impeachment inquiry proceedings. What did you find out?
It's close to a third who are paying real close attention, slightly more than a third paying fairly close attention, and then another roughly third paying little or no attention. The fairly close attention, the second category, did go up a little bit this month, suggesting that maybe people did tune in some. But the bottom line is it's a fairly even spread, with Democrats and Republicans paying about equal amounts of attention. But independents really pretty tuned out. A lot of independents are not paying much attention. And that's reflected with independents where close to or more than 50% say they don't know whether Trump asked for an investigation or withheld aid. So how much you paid attention does make some difference. And it's not a partisan difference, but attention to the hearings and the testimony. But that especially hits independents who are less engaged by it.
Talking to Charles Franklin from the Marquette Law School poll about the latest survey just out. Well, let's turn to the 2020 presidential election, a narrow 11 months away now. What did you find out, especially with this Democratic wide open field here?
Yeah, in terms of the primary, we still see a similar set of top four candidates, Biden at 23, Sanders at 19, Warren at 16, and Buttigieg at 15. Then you drop all the way off to 4% for Cory Booker and less for the rest of the field. That top four candidates has been pretty stable, except for Buttigieg rising from single digits and Kamala Harris falling out of the top tier and now withdrawing from the race. And it's a close race. Biden is a little tighter now. He was higher a month ago. But the consistency of the ranking is pretty striking. The other thing is 65% of Democratic voters say they might change their mind. So the field is far from set, and voters are far from having made up their mind here.
Well, and of course, a lot of them will have to change their mind. Presumably some of these candidates are going to drop out before Wisconsin gets to cast primary votes.
That's exactly right. And we normally see changes in the rankings in the polling as we get into the month before Iowa. So that'll be January this year. Iowa votes in early February. Then once we actually get votes taken in caucuses and primaries, people drop out. They can zoom up or they can zoom down. So we're a long ways away from our April primary. I think the question for us is going to be who's still in the race, who's viable. Maybe we end up like 2016, where a lot of people have dropped out, but there's still two top two contenders for us to be influential in. Of course, the alternative is the whole race is wrapped up by then.
And what about head-to-heads now, looking at the general election, where you compare a hypothetical Democratic primary winner to President Trump?
Right. There, the races have all tightened a little bit from a month ago. Last month, Trump had a small, mostly inside the margin of error advantage over the Democrats. This month, it's more mixed, and almost all of them are very, very close. This month, Biden leads Trump by just one percentage point. Trump leads Sanders by two. And then Trump leads Warren Buttigieg and Cory Booker by 1 point each. All of that's way inside the margin of error, and I think it just shows this is what a battleground state looks like in a pretty evenly divided electorate right now.
Let's take a quick look at job performance. What did we see for President Trump here in Wisconsin?
This month, Trump's job approval is 47% approved, 50% disapproved. It was 47-51 a month ago, so barely any movement. But that said, 47-50 does equal his best all-time reading here in the state, which came in October of 2018. So he's a little bit better, but we've just seen small incremental movements. One important thing is public opinion about the economy has gotten a little bit better this fall, and that's also reflected in Trump having an economic job approval of 53-45. So that's something that's helping him that tends to get overlooked in all of the conversation about impeachment.
We'll leave it there for now. Charles, thanks for joining us again today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School poll. We talked to them about their newest poll, It shows that 40% of registered voters in Wisconsin think President Trump should be impeached and removed from office. 52% think he should not. Coming up, our next guest says his family and friends haven't listened to a word he's said in years. Sounds like a perfect candidate to speak at UW-Madison's winter commencement. We'll talk with Wall Street Journal sports columnist and Badger grad Jason Gay coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, nearly 700,000 people receiving federal food assistance could be affected by a new Trump administration rule. We'll find out what changes and how it could affect Wisconsin. First, UW-Madison's winter commencement is Sunday. Let's say you're tasked with having to speak to the class of 2019, being rich in wisdom and a student of human nature. What kind of world-changing insight would you share with them? Reach for the stars, never stop dreaming, remember where you came from. How about beat the Wolverines? Our guest may say something like that last one at the Kohl Center this weekend. He's had a few weeks to come up with some material. Jason Gay is a sports columnist with the Wall Street Journal and a UW-Madison alum. Jason, good to have you back on the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. And listen, if you have any great lifelong insight, I could use it right about now. I got 24 hours about before this thing, so give it to me, okay?
Now, you've said that you're honored, yes, but kind of shocked that UW-Madison asked if you'd give this commencement address on Sunday.
Oh, come on. Let's face it. You know, I couldn't have been the first choice, right? You know, I'm incredibly honored. I mean, this is really something I never dreamed would ever happen, but let's be realistic. I think the last graduation speaker was J.J. Watt, who is a world-class all-pro football player who raised $40 million for the city of Houston. I pale in comparison, pale to that.
Now, you are, you know, you use a lot of humor in your column and I think in your daily life. I assume you're going to set all that aside and give a really serious, somber address this weekend?
Yeah. It's more or less like a 10-point plan for the nuclear disarmament of Western Europe. I hope the kids enjoy it. It'll probably take about 2.5 hours to get through the whole thing. It's very a meaty speech.
Now, this is a kind of an interesting moment for you, I imagine. And does it lead to some kind of self-reflection? Like, okay, what have I learned in my days since graduating?
Oh, sure. And, you know, as you know, anytime you speak in public, and you do it for a living, but when you speak in public, you can't help but be hit with a vicious case of imposter syndrome. And I've been just crippled by it for the last month or so, just ever since I got this opportunity. I'm somebody who wakes up in the morning not really knowing which way to turn. And the idea of speaking to a class of thousands of incredibly brilliant, and let's make no mistake about it, I could not get into Wisconsin in 2019. There's just no chance. The idea that I'm somehow equipped to give them pearls of wisdom is kind of laughable, but I'm going to do my best. You know, I'm just going to get up there or take big swings, and hopefully they won't fall asleep.
Looking back, what would Jason Gay, new college graduate, have wanted to hear in those days?
Oh, gosh. You know, it's funny to think about that. I think my college graduation speaker was, in fact, the journalist, Jeff Greenfield, who is a far more distinguished journalist than I ever have been. But I remember more or less being in Camp Randall and wanting to just get out of the sun. You know, I can't confess of thinking I was going into this thing with any huge expectations. I think I had gotten my cap and gown rather late from the university bookstore, and it may not have fit me, and I think my parents were already ready to kick me out of the house. So it's kind of a blur, to be honest with you.
Well, now talk about your path from there to being a columnist at one of the most prestigious newspapers in the country.
Well, you're very kind to put it that way. The truth of it is that I didn't have a master plan leaving Wisconsin. I went into newspapers on the ad sales side. I was an ad salesperson for the first couple of years I did it, and I was truly terrible at it. And this is not an exaggeration. I was so bad at selling advertising to this poor newspaper that the boss of it said, well, maybe we can convert him into a sports reporter. I mean, that's a true story. They said, this guy is so ineffectual as a salesperson, well, maybe we can just turn him into a sports writer. And here I am, you know, 25 years later doing that for a living. So I had the wisdom of somebody who was smart enough to know that I could do a career pivot. But, you know, look, if to be serious for a moment, you do a little bit of self-reflection, you know, in an opportunity like this. And I cannot speak enough about the, you know, bends and twists of luck and magical things that can happen along the way, but most importantly about the people who, you know, sacrificed and advised me along the way. And I've had the benefit of a lot of very tremendous mentors and editors along the way who, you know, took something less than a fully formed product and made it hopefully a little better.
Talking to Jason Gay, sports columnist with the Wall Street Journal, a UW-Madison alum and commencement speaker at their winter 2019 graduation ceremony. That's this weekend. By the way,
wait,
we've got
this weekend? It's Sunday?
Oh, wait.
Oh,
it is this.
Going.
I've got this right, right? Okay, good.
No, you do have it right. I'm
excellent.
Just kidding.
We've got a post up at the Ideas Network Facebook page, by the way. You can share your advice, say, for a new graduate. Our listeners can join in there and let us know what you think the new graduates need to hear or what you wish you had heard. That's on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Jason, we talked about this a little last time when you were in town. It took you a little while to build up your connection, your nostalgia, I guess, for Wisconsin.
Yeah, I mean, that's an absolute truth. And I don't think I'm alone in that. You know, when you go to college, you're kind of this, you know, young, emotional, touchy kind of person who is trying to sort of figure out their way in the world. And you're not terribly nostalgic to begin with. You're young. You're 19, 20, 21 years old. I'm much closer connected to Madison and Wisconsin than I was when I actually went there. I feel so strongly that it's such a wonderful place. But bringing my kids this weekend, and I would love for them to consider it as a school. You know, probably won't put my name on the application if we want them to get in. But I feel... you know, this is one of the things that happens. You get a little older, you get a little more nostalgic, and you think about the times in your life when you're most happy, and Madison was certainly one of those for me.
Now, you're in New York now, and I know, like, for the Green Bay Packers, they've got this, you know, national, even international fandom where you can kind of run into Packer fans anywhere. Do you feel that? Do you feel like there's this Wisconsin mafia out there that you run into no matter where you go?
I truly do. I mean, and we'll get a taste of why that's so when you see how many people are graduating on Sunday. I mean, we graduate them big in Madison, and these are big classes, and it's a big school. And yes, I mean, the diaspora is far and wide, and I'm always shocked at how they can always make it to last call, no matter what city in the world you're in.
And you are still in touch with sports here at UW. Last time we talked to you, you'd written that column on you know, how Wisconsin can save the world by beating Michigan. How'd that game come out again?
I made it happen with my gentle words in the Wall Street Journal. And yes, the Badgers turned around and beat up the Wolverines. One of the great days I've ever had on campus. You know, the season has had some strange moments. We won't mention what happened in Illinois, but this is a team that did some really impressive things, and I'm glad that they're getting the opportunity to experience a Rose Bowl. I still believe in the Rose Bowl being a meaningful moment. I know the playoff has come and sort of diluted everything, but I still want to beat the junk out of the Pac-12, so it's still important to me.
Well, in that championship game against Ohio State, there's a great first half. I turned away after that. What happened next?
Yeah, well, they just called the game right then and there, and Ohio State went home in shame. I turned it off the same. I haven't heard anything since. Have you?
No. I love our selective editing of sports history here.
Yeah,
this is great.
Yeah. I mean, I came away from that game with a very strong opinion, which is that college football games really should be just two quarters. And because once you call them two quarters, they're basically two halves. And there you go.
You just do the math. Multiply by two.
Yeah.
We heard on Facebook from Steven. We asked for people's advice for graduates. Steven says, just because you've graduated, congrats, by the way, he says, realize that your education is not over. Keep learning every chance you can. And quickly in the real world, don't get discouraged when you get schooled in the world outside of college. What do you think, Jason?
I think, what's the gentleman's name?
Steven, yeah.
Steven, can you be there at 9 a.m. on Sunday morning? Because I can just plagiarize everything you write. That just sounds fantastic to me. Listen, all of that is incredible wisdom. And I don't think I'm going to learn this either, that as you get older, you feel a little guilty about the opportunity, the lack of taking advantage sometimes we do in school, the opportunity to just sort of sit and spend time with books and really study and focus on one or two things. You know, our lives get crazier and crazier as we get older, children enter, jobs get weirder. It's the kind of luxury of learning is something that cannot stop with just college.
You know, Jason, I don't know if you're here, too. I've got kids. We're doing college visits nowadays, and I feel like I'm just starting to figure out what I want out of a college as I go on these visits with them. Do you ever look back and think, oh, if I had to do it over again, I would have blank at college?
Oh, yeah, I mean, no question. I mean, this is probably not the kind of thing you want your commencement speaker to be admitting on the eve of commencement, but I probably would have studied a little bit harder.
Yeah.
I probably would have applied myself a little bit more, especially in some of those comparative literature classes that I was maybe dozing off on in the back of. But I lucked out with Wisconsin. It was a school that someone recommended to me. I came from Massachusetts. I was not, familiar with the school terribly much, and it changed my life in so many positive ways. And now, I have this wonderful family. You can hear my child smashing Legos in the background.
Nice.
Things are wonderful. And it speaks to what you're saying, that, like, we don't really know. We don't, and to the students who are out there making those decisions, choices, and hopefully you have choices, and even if you don't, these things tend to work out. I think we put too much stock in focusing on one thing when, life is just, a series of happenstances often.
Now, you've mentioned that imposter syndrome, that feeling you have, Jason. You're not alone in that. Probably a lot of these new grads are going to be feeling like that. Any thoughts on how to, and these young people today, they're pretty smart, I'm finding. Any advice for them to get over their own imposter syndrome?
Well, it's the job of the previous generation to always dump on the next generation, right? And there's no shortage of that, right? People dumping on millennials or Gen Z or any, people who are under the age of 35 as being entitled or this or that. And the truth of it is, you're 1,000% right. They're so much sharper, more fluent, so many things than you or I ever were or will be. I think that they should, if they're entering any kind of new environment, just have the comfort in the fact that things are not going to just go according to plan. You can't script, the first 6 months of your life, much as you can't script the next 16 years of it. It really is, a woefully and sometimes exhilaratingly chaotic experience. And I think that's the best part. The thing that I'm most envious of these students, besides their full heads of hair and beautiful unblemished skin, is that open road that's out in front of them. The fact that they are just looking at, any different number of different directions they can spin off from here, that's just an incredible, enviable thing.
Jason, thanks a lot, and enjoy your trip back to Wisconsin.
I appreciate it greatly. And again, Stephen and anybody out there, if you have any ideas, meet me in front of the Kohl Center around 9 o'clock and just give them to me on index cards. I appreciate it. Thank you all.
That's Jason Gay, sports columnist with the Wall Street Journal, UW-Madison graduate and commencement speaker this weekend at the UW-Madison's winter commencement. Stick around, more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday after 6 on the morning show, the American coyote population has expanded to 49 states, and Wisconsin is one of those 49. Two wildlife experts join the show for a look at coyotes and how they interact with humans in cities and suburbs. That's Monday morning after 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, a new rule announced last week by the Trump administration could have a big impact on some people who rely on food assistance. The change affects job requirements for some people who receive benefits from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also known as SNAP. Here's Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue talking about the intent of the rule change on CNBC last week.
What we want to do is increase employment. We need these people in the workforce,
right?
People who've been on the welfare, been on food stamps. We're trying to get them, and sometimes it is difficult when you've been out of a job for a long time. We're trying to help these people get back into personal dignity of work and becoming part of the productive economy of the United States.
Sarah Halpern-Meekin is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin's School of Human Ecology, where, among other topics, she studies the effect of the changing welfare system on low-income families. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, food aid policy can be complicated. Can you tease out for us what this particular rule change actually does?
Yeah, so there have been a number of rule change proposals, and so I think this is a good question. What exactly are we talking about today? Which is the specific one that's going to go into effect soon? So the one that we're discussing today is a rule change proposal that adjusts the ability of states to access work requirement waivers for their residents. So the rule in place now is that a person who is able-bodied between 18 and 49, I believe, and has no dependent children, can only receive SNAP benefits for 3 months out of a 36-month period unless they meet work requirements. And states are able to apply for waivers so that people can receive benefits for longer than those 3 months if they have higher unemployment. And this restricts the ability of states to request those waivers.
And how common has it been for states to request to waivers and I guess get waivers from that requirement?
It's pretty common. There are several states that actually have the waiver that applies to their entire state. And I believe every state except for Delaware has gotten a waiver, applied for a waiver at some point in time. So it's not just one kind of state or another kind of state that gets these. This is something all states have made use of at different points in time.
And you mentioned sometimes it's a whole state, but sometimes it might be, hey, we've got this economically depressed area with really high unemployment. Is that a kind of waiver that someone might request?
Right. So these waivers are based on unemployment. And what this rule change does is it ups the ante for the standards a state would have to make or meet or an area would have to meet in order to qualify for a waiver. So it makes it harder for states or economically depressed areas to extend the time frame for SNAP receipt to their residents if they're facing employment difficulties in the area.
And what have we done with those kind of waivers here in Wisconsin?
So I can't speak specifically to when exactly over time we've gotten them in Wisconsin. We certainly know that there are different areas of Wisconsin that face different unemployment rates. We know that there's higher SNAP benefit receipt, for example, in northern Wisconsin. A lot of families up there are relying on food assistance. And then we also have a lot of variety around central Wisconsin. We have much higher unemployment rates in some of our counties than in others. The other thing to keep in mind is I want to make sure we don't just talk about unemployment rates, but we remember that unemployment doesn't take into account anybody who's not working or actively seeking work. So anybody who's out of the labor force isn't considered in these rules. And that can make it more complicated to figure out which of our areas actually need help when.
Talking about rule changes in the Federal Food Assistance Program with Sarah Halpern-Meekin from UW's School of Human Ecology. Taking a little step back, what do we know about the impact of these kind of work requirements on federal food aid and whether it prevents people from getting food aid or, as we heard Sonny Perdue saying, gets them into the workforce?
So the administration is predicting that about 700,000 people will across the country will lose SNAP benefits with this rule change. So we know that that's a change that's going to happen. Fewer people will be getting food assistance. There is not evidence that suggests that cutting back on food aid increases people's likelihood of working. The amount of money that we're talking about here, the average individual benefit is about $127 a month. That's certainly not enough money for anybody to choose to live on. So the idea that that there's a trade-off between getting these SNAP benefits or working doesn't really reflect the economic reality for most folks.
I want to give another listen to Secretary Perdue, again talking to CNBC here, about going after the waivers states had been able to make regarding these work requirements.
Now we've got more jobs based on the Trump's economy than we've got people for apply for them. We're going back to the original congressional intent. That's what the administration is supposed to do. Look at the original congressional intent and go back there. So we're eliminating those waivers except for those people who are naturally exempt.
So the argument there that we've kind of gone beyond the original intent of the original food assistance legislation.
So this rule change proposal was actually in the 2018 Farm Bill, and Congress didn't pass it. So it's not that Congress has said this is what we want this program to be, and the Trump administration is just bringing it back to that. I think there's disagreement in Congress, but Congress did not choose to implement this rule. So this is something the administration has chosen to advance.
And Secretary Perdue there referred to the state of the economy. Does it make sense to change rules from, say, the depths of the Great Recession when a lot more people were out of work and may have needed some kind of food assistance to now after many years of economic recovery?
We're in a vast country where the economic experiences of people are going to vary widely from place to place. And so I think we want to keep in mind, we don't want to create a food assistance program, you know, for cities that are booming when we know that there are other places where people aren't feeling that boom. It feels more like a bust time. So keeping in mind that we have that wide variety, we also want to remember that we want to have programs that are set up so they can respond when we do encounter a crisis situation. There are some estimates that suggest that this rule change would make it harder for this federal policy to respond if we were to see unemployment rates increase again.
Right. I've heard the phrase countercyclical used to refer to programs like food stamps, which, as I understand it, means when things get bad, the spending goes up. When the economy goes down, the spending goes up. So then it sounds like you're saying, okay, if we're a state like Wisconsin, we're hit by the next recession, whenever that might happen, this change would make it harder for us to say, look, unemployment went up a lot here in this last year. We need to get these waivers again.
Right. So it just decreases the flexibility for states of responding quickly and in line with their changes in unemployment that they're seeing in their areas.
So it sounds like this waiver or this change, I should say, to the waiver system would take effect next year. I mean, is it the thought that that's almost 700,000 people could potentially lose food aid pretty quickly after that, or maybe 3 months after that?
Yes. So, you know, we're talking about a short time span in which people are eligible for benefits. So we would see this substantial number of people coming off benefits, you know, in the near future.
Does Wisconsin stand out as being particularly dependent on federal food aid, or less so, or kind of in the middle of the pack when it comes to states around the country?
So as I said, you know, I like to look at that variation across
sure.
the state. And so there are some counties where there are a substantial number of families who are dependent on food assistance to stretch their grocery bills. And there are other counties in Wisconsin where that's much less the case. So it's going to have a disproportionate impact across our state.
And some critics now of this rule change have said this is going to put a lot of work on social service providers and states who have to verify eligibility here. Is that, I guess, bureaucratic element part of the story we should be watching here?
I think that's a more pressing issue with some of the other rule changes that have been proposed with the SNAP legislation. It certainly is the case that if you want to be documenting people's work efforts, there's an administrative burden that comes with that. So, yes, I mean, that adds to what our state agencies need to do to administer the program.
And as you mentioned, this isn't the only rule in the works. What other possible rule changes are you watching for from the Trump administration?
So one of the key ones that has been discussed is changing the asset rules, whether assets need to be checked for people who are already on other programs, and then something called categorical eligibility, which is related, which is to say, if I'm getting another kind of means-tested benefit, like I'm getting cash welfare, for example, I don't have to go through and have everything verified again for the SNAP program since the eligibility is similar. If I'm qualified for that first program, I'm categorically eligible for that second program. And so the administrative rule change would make that harder to be the case. And that is likely to affect some families' ability to receive SNAP and also affect the ability of children in those families to qualify for free or reduced price lunch.
So would the likely outcome of both of those changes also be to take some people off of the food assistance lists?
Yeah, I believe the estimate is that we would see a decline of about 3.7 million people on the SNAP rolls. So almost 4 million fewer people receiving SNAP were all these proposed changes to go into place.
We're talking with Sarah Halpern-Meekin, UW-Madison Assistant Professor of Sociology in the School of Human Ecology. We're talking about a rule change to the federal food assistance program. It affects this particular rule we're focusing on, involves work requirements for what are being referred to as able-bodied recipients from the age of 18 to 49. It would make it harder for states to get waivers, exemptions from those work requirements. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on these changes? Are you or have you ever been reliant on food stamps as they used to be or SNAP benefits? How did the program impact you? What do you think about the work requirements in general requiring people to prove that they are working or seeking seeking work. There are some other eligibility requirements. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with sociologist and assistant professor Sarah Halpern-Meekin. She's with the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. We're talking about a new rule change for the Trump administration to work requirements for federal food assistance, making it, in effect, harder for states to waive those federal requirements for the whole state or in areas with higher unemployment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the way these food aid benefits, SNAP benefits, work, how people in Wisconsin use them, the impact of this rule change? If you've used federal food aid yourself, you can share your experience with us and your thoughts on the requirements for it. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Brad is with us in Saukville. Brad, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Brad?
I feel like this legislation, this rule or whatever, is basically a target for lower-income families. And I feel like this is the government's way of basically saying, you know what, you just don't have that six-figure bank account we're looking for. So, you know, if you can't make it, we don't care. And you know, that's how it feels. I mean, I'm an able-bodied individual. I have a seasonal job. I do pool construction, pool maintenance, pool technician between the months of March, November, depending on what the season looks like. And, you know, come, you know, my off-season, I can see the government saying, well, technically you're able-bodied. You should have to work. And I do agree with that. But at the same time, I don't think they understand that as a seasonal employee, you know how hard it is to find a job that'll work with, listen, I don't know when my season is going to end, nor do I know when it's going to begin.
Brad, thanks a lot for your call and sharing your experience. Sarah, seasonal workers in Brad's case might feel an impact from this.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not just the pool construction industry. We can think of road construction, right? We don't know when that last freeze is going to happen in Wisconsin and the construction workers can get out and start putting up cones and, you know, building our roads. And there are so many industries where people have this kind of unknowns in their work that can make it really hard to plan. So there are a lot of people who are facing employment situations the way that Brad was describing that can make it really hard to comply with these work rules.
Brad, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Mary Kate in Kenosha. Mary Kate, hi.
Hi. My concerns are these. There are people out there that don't have a high school. They don't have the transportation. They have no home. They have temporary jobs. And these are the people you're going to, and no health care, and you're going to take these people off food stamps.
Mary Kate, thanks for the call. Mary Kate worried about people kind of at the bottom of the economic ladder, maybe people without high school diplomas as well.
Yeah, so it's definitely the case that one of the things people who are in advocacy positions who are looking out for lower income folks get worried about is with lower access to consistent food, what is that going to mean for people's health and well-being? We know that for people with diabetes, for example, having regular access to high quality food is really important. And so as we think about these rule changes, it's important for us to think about impacts on people, but also what might they do to the expenses that we face in other ways? So if somebody gets Medicaid, our government health insurance, for example, are we going to face increased costs there because they don't have access to regular healthy food someplace else?
Thanks for that call. We'll go now to Mo with us in Oconto. Mo, hi.
Hi. Couple of comments here. One is the multiplier effect on every dollar we spend, how much actually comes back. I think this is going to hurt some grocery stores, especially the smaller ones that may have to close because they have a lot of SNAP recipients. And the third one is, I think you just got to be careful what party you vote for.
Mo, thanks for the call. Have you looked into the multiplier effects? He was talking about the economic outcome of food aid like this.
Yeah, work by economists has supported what Mo was talking about, that for every dollar somebody receives in SNAP, that money is spent. So that's not money people can save in their pockets, and they spend it in local businesses. And so we do see it as a potential engine of economic growth in an area because these dollars are often being spent in lower resourced areas. It's one reason why there has been bipartisan support for a long time for SNAP, especially from Republicans from farm states, because the amount of money that Americans spend on groceries directly impacts the well-being of our farmers.
Thanks for that call, Mo. We're talking to Sarah Halpern-Meekin from UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, looking at changes in rules for federal food assistance, in particular rule change on work requirements for particular recipients and states' ability to get waivers from those requirements. We'll go now to Troy on the line in Muskego. Troy, hello.
Hello. I just want to make a couple of points here. Number one, there was two major things that happened in Wisconsin, which was a lot of people were with the work requirements, and also the other one was it's harder to file unemployment. These are things that political parties use to try and make it look like to get people so they're not filing unemployment. So basically they try and take credit and say that the unemployment rate is down, and that's really because a lot of people are actually going hungry. A lot of people are kicked off these programs. I want to say we should change the conversation. Why don't we raise wages? And I think if we raise wages, because there's people that are actually on these programs that do work. And actually there's people that are working two or three jobs, and they need to get the assistance to go along with it. I think they need to raise wages, and we need to expand our grants for higher education or the trades.
I'm going to jump in. Troy, you gave us a lot to work with already there. Let's talk about that, and this might not be affected by the work requirement change, but saying that a lot of people who receive food aid are employed.
Yeah, so there are a substantial proportion of the adults who receive food aid who are employed. It's important to keep in mind that a lot of the people who receive food aid would fall into the categories of being children, being elderly, or being disabled. And so even when we look at the proportion of people who are adults on the SNAP rolls, many of them will also fall into this disabled category. It can also be a tricky category because that the way we count it just includes people who are on Social Security disability, one of those two programs. And that ignores all the people who are waiting to get disability, for example. It can be a years-long process. So people can't work during that time. And how are we going to make sure that people who are disabled but not receiving disability are able to get by is one question we need to think about.
So that able-bodied category here might not be as clear-cut as we might think hearing the phrase.
Exactly. So the able-bodied category is not as clear-cut, and the no-dependence category is also not as clear-cut because it just means that you are not the custodial parent for children, the primary custodial parent. So this category includes a lot of people who might be facing mental or physical health issues and also a lot of people who actually our parents.
Time for one more caller. Let's go to Carol with us in Burlington. Carol, hi.
Good afternoon. I had mentioned I was a recipient as a single parent with four children in the mid-80s, both public assistance and food stamps at the time. And I think my piece is that this is actually doable in its current proposal.
Your line is breaking up pretty well there, Carol. Sorry about that, but thank you for calling in. Just a few moments left. Actually, Sarah, what are you watching for next when it comes to federal rules and guidelines on food assistance?
Well, I think we need to wait and see how these things are implemented, what those exact numbers are going forward in terms of the rules that states will need to meet in order to request these waivers. And we'll also want to keep an eye on those other administrative rule change proposals that are coming up. Those are things that people have been making comments on. There have been a lot of comments that they've received from the public on these proposals, and it remains to be seen when and whether these additional proposals are going to go into effect, because then we're talking about affecting nearly 4 million people.
We'll watch for those changes. Sarah, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Sarah Halpern-Meekin, Assistant Professor of Sociology at the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. We talked to her today about a new rule on food assistance from the Trump administration. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, the Washington Post reporter who broke the Afghanistan Papers story says the U.S. military told two stories about Afghanistan, an optimistic one to the public and a skeptical one behind closed doors. Some of the most inspiring and most shared links on social media were spread by Russian troll accounts. We'll find out why and how it helps Russian intelligence agencies manipulate Americans. And we'll find out the value of sharing family stories with the next generation, something you might do over the holidays. That and more, all coming up Monday here on Central Time.